Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today I am really excited to talk about self-management and self-organization. And in our pre-call, we had a nice conversation, and I kept making these jumps and leaps and inferences, and you gently put me back on the path of, like, this is what it is. So very, very welcome to the podcast, Eugenio Molini.
Molini.
It's good to have you.
Thank you.
I'm going to start us off in the way that I always do on this podcast, with the super light and simple question of who are you, Eugenio Molini?
Oh, shit. Who am I? It's always the most difficult question. Some periods of my life, I would know exactly who I am. No? But, well, I am the guy speaking with you, and that I am excited about whatever comes up in this conversation. No? That's the most here and now presentation of myself. No? I am the guy that's speaking with you just now, and I am excited about this conversation.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you. And I have this idea that we would talk about, I think maybe some self-management and maybe some self-organization and maybe something around culture and people and working together. And why would I ask the guy that is speaking to me at the moment and that is excited about this conversation about those things?
Why? Okay. Well, I can't say why you would ask me, but I know why I would, why I became interested in this, no? And there are many ways where this, my interest started. But one place is when I was 17 years old, I saw myself as an anarchist. And I was I was born and brought up in the Spanish dictatorship with Franco. So I went out to demonstrate, and the first demonstration I went to, the police caught me, and I got 1 month in jail. And when I was in jail, I was I had the luck, because you could say the luck, to be in the same cell as an anarchist that had been many years in jail, no? And he was one of my very meaningful teacher. And he put two books that were completely forbidden in Spain at that point, no? But in some way they had found its way into the jail. And the two books were Man's Search for Meaning of Viktor Frankl, and the other one was Towards an Ecology of the Mind of Gregory Bateson. And about the Towards an Ecology of the Mind, I didn't understand anything. I thought I did, but I didn't understand anything. But it put in me the seed to wanting to understand more. What's this about culture? What's this about organizations and ways we build reality with our thoughts, and we create ways of thinking and so on. But I didn't understand much. And the second book, the one, Man's Search for Meaning, nourished and gave me permission, I would say permission, to seek inwards, to seek what's the point of life, of my life, what is the purpose of my life, and what is the connection between the purpose of my life and the systems outside of me, no? The culture, the organization, society, and so on. So I would say that that's the origin of my interest, and the rest of my life has been to follow in those two paths. No? What's the meaning of life, and what happens in the interface between me and the world, and what happens out there in the world.
That's fascinating. I just read the Gregory Bateson book, Steps to an Ecology of Mind, and queued up for me in my little list of reading is Frankl. I haven't got to him yet, but he's going to soon enter into my life. So now I'm more
two books that made very much impact in me.
And then, so you're 17, you're in jail in Spain, and I don't usually do this, but it's kind of fun to, how do you end up, a few years later in Sweden, speaking to me here? Because you've been working with the unions, and you've been working with a number of organizations all over at least Europe.
Many hundreds of organizations, yes.
So it seems, what happened to the anarchist? Is he still there?
Yes, it's still there, very clearly. It's still there. But I am not an angry anarchist anymore. No? When I was 17, I was a very angry anarchist. I would say even that I was an impossibility, but all too common impossibility. It's an angry and authoritarian anarchist, I would say, because I was very angry and I thought that I knew the solution for everything, no? But I didn't have a clue. No? I can say that I have been an anarchist my whole life, but the content of this anarchism has been changing, no? From being something that is anger towards anything that smelled of oppression, it changed towards compassion for human nature and human suffering and human greatness, whatever, no? You can call it, no? The light and the shadows of humanity and how we all, everybody wants to get somewhere where we can live in peace and in a place of love, no? And that's a completely different anarchism and the one I was defending at once upon a time. No? And in my work with organizations, it has been evolving from more or less self-righteous place of trying to open spaces of freedom within organizations and so on, until I understood that, the organizations are not about that. No? Organizations are about doing a work together, people doing a work together, and at the same time, people that want to live in peace and have a happy life, no? And how to combine those things. So from being the activist, angry activist, I became, along the years, more and more downsizing, no? From believing that I knew how things should be, to becoming a Trojan horse, to becoming a Trojan mice, to becoming a worm, worming around in the organizations, trying, you know. And somebody told me, no, you are not even a worm, you are now a microbe. But you know, it's the kind of worms that the quality of the soil for plants and for growth is many times measured in how many worms are worming around, no? So you could say that it has been a slow but clear downsizing of the importance that I ascribed myself and the place, existential place from which I tried to promote change in the organizations. No?
And I think what comes up in me is something you said, or the way that I maybe misunderstood you in the previous call, was that when you said that you work with structures, which I thought was interesting, like that it's not necessarily, I mean, of course you work with people, I guess, but nonetheless, you were very focused on the structures, and I'm curious.
Yes, it is. I trained in the 80s as a therapist, no? So my original interest, at least professional, was towards working with people, no? And when I began to work with organizations, I I continued doing coaching with individuals. But at some point, I understood that there's something in the out there in the world that influences so much people that I would like to understand more about the world, not only about individuals and relationships. So I began to be interested in, yeah, how do organizations work and how do organizations influence people? No? And then I want to reconnect with Viktor Frankl, mm-hmm. A Man's Search for Meaning, no? Because one of the things that is very evident in the book is that even in the concentration camp, when everything is dehumanizing, people could keep their sense of humanity. So that was what I was interested in. How can I contribute to create structures where people don't need to fight for keeping their sense of humanity, as you would do in a concentration camp and in many organizations where everything is about deadlines, about goals, about measurement, about things like that, no? That in the end, it's like the organization tends to dehumanize people and people need to fight or find ways of creating spaces of sanity, no? And then I say, well, how can I influence structures so that people don't need to adapt so much to sick structures and sick, or not even sick, maybe sometimes it's that they are non-functional. No? Because they are not good for people, but they are not good for the work either. No? So that's my interest now. How, see, it's like, Do you remember? Do you know what Michelangelo said to when he saw a block of marble, and somebody asked him, "But where is the Venus, or where's the angel in this marble block?" And he said, "You just take out what is. You just take out the excess, and then what's left is the angel or the statue." No, so it's the same thing. You just take in the organizations everything that is. Excess, no? And then what do you have? The organization you need, and that helps people, supports people to work towards the task on the common task, no? So,
but how? It's really interesting. I mean, I share the. I haven't been at this as long, of course, but still, there is this. I can really relate to what you're looking at, and then. I've been part of very small teams because I've been working in startups, and then now lately I've been interacting with more like public organizations, and there's a completely different logic there, and it's very confusing when I come in and think that we are solving the task, but there are so many other things that are also on the agenda at the same time, like political positioning, and things should take a certain time, and we need to negotiate with those people and that people, and there's a lot of other stuff that's going on. That I'm discovering because I'm inexperienced in working with large organizations, and I'm catching up. But it becomes very strange sometimes because things that seem very simple get very complex. But how, if it doesn't serve the people and it definitely doesn't serve the task, and the task is like the organization is there to solve the task, why do this? Why does it occur?
Well, just because we are human, that's what happens, and we are all touched in one way or another. That makes us, instead of being task oriented, we are more oriented towards greed, or towards power, or towards money, or towards influence, or towards prestige, or whatever, no? Because we believe that will give us the kind of satisfaction that we are looking for, but that's just like taking a drug that you always want more and more and more, no? It never satisfies, no? But we are human and we do that, no? Knowing that is human nature, and that's what one of the things for many of the things that people do: power games, corruption, control, whatever. Mm-hmm. No? Knowing that that is part of the territory, then okay, it's like you see Öresund between Sweden and Denmark. It's there, no? So deal with it. Navigate there. Well, you can swim over, you can fly over, you can, so, but don't try to change it. It's there, no? Don't fight against what you can't change, or what the cost of changing it would be so big, not so much for you, but also for all the people that would need to change for that to disappear.
Mm.
So take it as part of the territory, and try to do the best you can in those circumstances. Possibly, if possible, without yourself becoming manipulative, greedy, playing power games, etc., etc. No? If possible. You see, like this morning, I was speaking with somebody, and he said, I have in the end accepted a permanent position within one organization after 20 years of working as a freelance consultant. No? And he said more or less how he was working, and I said, okay, instead of preaching about and trying to promote and change the world, what you are doing is being the change you want to see in the world. No? So it's like the shift from trying to change the world to trying to embody yourself in all your endeavors, the change you want to promote. No? Because then you are powerful in the change, because you are at the same time an embodiment of that change that you want to see in the world, and you have the tools and the knowledge and the know-how how to design and facilitate meetings and change processes and so on, so that others, if they want, join.
That's interesting, because it's also tricky, because that's what I found when I started out on reading up more on like culture and these things of change processes and change management and all of that stuff. And it's so treacherous to, at least for me, I was thinking, oh, it's so good, then I can come in as I am, and I can change all those people over there, and then they will do the right thing, and I'm already as I am, so it doesn't come at a cost. And the more that I interact with it, the more I realize, of course, that unless I take the consequences myself, unless I'm willing to change, I mean, nothing's ever going to move. Then we're just talking about a lot of nice things.
I thought that once upon a time also, you know, that I would be a magician, that my pure presence would be enough. And it's not, you know, because I am just a worm, a microbe, or one agent among many that want to do something in that given context, organization, company, or whatever, no? So, but that temptation is there for all change agents, you know? Everybody that wants to change the world, to believe that you yourself can make a difference in the big picture. And some people do, no? But most of us, we do as the best we can, and sometimes it's very little and sometimes it's very much.
But I want to return to what you said about, so we have the sort of the human nature, or like the way that we move, and like the organizations that we move in, they are a result of how we see the world in a way. So yeah. How do you go about creating that space for peace, or that sort of less lowering the insanity a little bit? What are the components, and how do you go about it?
Well, one of the first things you need to do and come back to all the time is to yourself. So how can I be more and more a sane person, a person that is in connection with what is important, really important in life, no? While I at the same time work to deliver whatever needs to be delivered, no? Because that one thing doesn't always exclude the other, no? Sometimes it does, no? Depends on what the organization is doing and so on. So, but that is the first thing, no? And then become a good artisan. Know your tools, know other people's nature, know how people function together, what we create together, and be very listen a lot, but not necessarily to what people are saying, but how people are saying things, no? To understand when can you ask a question, when is better for you to be quiet and don't say anything and just wait. When to come with an affirmation, no? And knowing that whatever you do, the moment you have said it, you have lost control of it. It's not yours anymore. It's everybody else's. And people will do whatever they want with it, no matter your intention, no? So, in a way, is do your thing and get out of the way. No, do your thing and get out of the way. Because if you try to control the effects of what you have done or said or not said, or so, then you are trying to manipulate and you are trying to control other people. And people have had enough of that.
That's, yeah. When you said that, as soon as I had said something, then it's not mine anymore and it's not for me to control, I felt like there's a clear contraction in me of fear. You know, it just did something.
We don't need to go to the organizational world. When you say "I love you" to someone, do you have control about whatever happens afterwards? You have no clue, no? No clue. When somebody says "I love you" to you, it's impossible to control the effects of what you say or don't say, no? So it's the same thing in the organizational world, no? You give instructions, you believe that everybody has understood because they are very methodological. And say, and then when you go to look at what people are doing, they are doing something completely different. So, well, that's the way it is. That's the way we are.
So I'm searching for a way back to the structural component. How does that relate to structure then?
Okay. Let's take a detour to come back to this, no? Mm-hmm. As much as human nature is about being afraid, trying to control, trying to manipulate, trying to have power, trying to have money, trying whatever, no? It is also about a deep yearning and a deep longing for making it short to for paradise and for unconditional love. At the center of every human being, that's my belief and my experience. You know, it's a belief that is confirmed by experience once and again, you know, that when you ask really with curiosity and compassion and care, more than compassion, care to anybody, what they long most to, what they long after, a place where they don't need to be afraid. And people often explain it in negative. I want to stop being afraid. I want a place where I am accepted. I want a place where I am. I don't need to protect myself, etc., etc. And in the end, it sounds like paradise. Yes, more or less. Yeah. And on the other hand, it's also about being loved unconditionally. I long after being loved, and I long after being able to love unconditionally. So that's at the center also. All the other things, greed, power games, etc., are, we do that to protect this inner core, because these two longings are so vulnerable. We are so vulnerable when we are in contact with that, that anybody can hurt us very much if we are really, really in contact with that. So most organizations, it is not possible to show that you are, even to speak about your deeper longing, because then you are a dead person. Sometimes I think that mediocrity is an unholy pact between men and women that have decided not to hurt each other. And the best way of not hurting each other is never showing any vulnerability or putting anybody in position of being vulnerable. Of never being in a position where you are in contact with your capacity to love and your journey after paradise. No? For a short name. No? So let's not speak about that. Let's not touch that. Let's just be task-oriented. Just be results-oriented. No? And if somebody gets in a life situation that touches them in this deeper layer, then you send them to a coach. But please don't disturb the organization. That's mediocrity, because my experience is also that we produce the most, we are the most excited, the most centered in doing our work in a flow, and so when we are in contact with our capacity to love, and we don't need to protect ourselves, meaning when we are in paradise. And then when we get a task that captures our interest, then we are in flow and everything works, no? So that is the connection to structures. That the moment you take away the structures that hurt people, people will be able to be less afraid and more in contact with their journey to love and be loved. So that's it, no? One way of working with this is therapy, coaching, individual, maybe even team development in some people's style of working is about this, no? About inviting people, training them to communicate in a more humane way, non-violent, etc. And that is has its value, no? But I chose instead to work with the structures. Take away the excess, as Michelangelo was saying. Take away what shouldn't be there. But of course, there is an apparent contradiction, because I say it's not me that takes it away, because I come as an external consultant, and who I am to tell people what they need to take away or not. No? But when people have experienced in a team, for example, or in a large scale meeting with 200 or 300 people, when they have had the experience of working task-oriented without needing to be afraid, without being attacked or without needing to attack anybody, without the need for power games, and without the need of complying with meaningless rules, they want more. They always want more. I remember once in a team of in Brussels, with a team of international team of commercials, people that sellers, no, people that were going around to big accounts, European scale accounts, no. So because they have noticed that the different countries were going towards the same multinationals and they were cannibalizing each other's market, and they said, now we do a European, pan-European team of commercials, or sellers, or so. Okay. And then I told them just a list of all the ways that we can really hurt each other in workplaces. No? So just a list, how to ridicule, make invisible, withdraw, hiding information, you know, the master suppressions techniques. No? Mm-hmm. I made this list. No? And then three guys, one from Italy, one from Greece, and another from Spain, they said, but that's normal. They said, yes, that's the problem. But you say, when you say normal, is that this cut is habitual? Is that it happens all the time? Or do you mean that it's normal as it should be?
Yeah.
Well, it's as it should be. The thing is that the people in the north of Europe in that team said, no, that's not the way it should be. It's normal because it's very usual, but it's normal because it should be the norm. So it was very evident, a clash of cultures there. No? Yeah. So some people are so used to being oppressed and to being hurt at work by each other and by the organization, no? And the structures. No? Like, for example, one structure is, how do you give, I don't remember the words. How do you appraise performance? Is it individually? Or is it as a team? Well, each one of those has consequences for the kind of culture you are developing. No? Huh? In many organizations, they say, we want to develop a collaborative culture. And then they evaluate performance only at the individual level. Okay, they are giving mixed messages. No? And people will not know what to do. That's a structure.
Yes. Yeah, So just to kind of try to reflect it back in the way that, in a way, you could say that if we had perfect people, we need no structure. And if we had the perfect structure, we don't need, people. And then we end up in between there because there are all these ways of interacting with the world that we have learned, or like these habitual things are coming in the way of. And so there's like a conversation going on between the person and the structure and the task.
No, but I mean, there's a very premise that I don't buy. There's nothing perfect. It's very dangerous to believe in perfection. No, there's nothing perfect. There's nobody perfect. No, it's not about perfect people and about perfect structures. It's about adequate enough structures for the task with the people that are there. Just like that, no? And there's no perfect behavior, there's not perfect people, there's no perfect anything. It's the same person in one context can be a star. And you just move them sideways or upwards in the organization, not very much, just a little bit, and they end in another context, and then they are nothing. So they can't work, they can't develop, no? So is this thing that I am me, everybody is yourself, everyone is him or herself, and we cannot escape the context, no? It's the same thing as saying, do your thing and get out of the way. So you are what the context allows you to be. So there's nothing perfect. More, is there a fit or not? No. And the thing, for example, going back to the concentration camps, in the concentration camps, there's no fit for anybody. And anyhow, people find ways of keeping, some of people, not everybody, some people find ways of keeping in touch with their own humanity. Just read Viktor Frankl, no? So, even in the most poisonous organizations, there are people that succeed in keeping themselves human. And many others just dehumanize themselves. They detach themselves from their own capacity for love, even for love for themselves, for others, for the organization, and for the planet, and for everybody. You know? And that's a problem. That's a big problem. No? But perfect, there's nothing perfect. But we have the yearning for perfect love. We can long after it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we will ever achieve it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's something like that's I think where I was headed as well. But just this, because it's tricky to think about excess. Like we say, just remove the excess. I mean, in a way, it sounds very simple. But then excess in different contexts, it means completely different things.
Yes, exactly.
And also relating to the task complexity, or like how much room. If we're building an airplane, we might have a lower tolerance for failure than if we are building a go kart or
yes.
That's a bad example, but you know, yes. Something else.
Yeah, but just look around you. If you look at the room where you are, how many things are there that are in excess that you don't need? No? Books that you will never read anymore that you haven't read, that they have been there in the shelves for 15 years and you know that you will never read. Papers from, I don't know, many things. So you can do the same thing with organization.
Yeah.
What do we need? No, the thing is, but this is also interesting, no? That size matters. So it's not the same thing, a team of five people, that you can, it's very easy to keep it with only the essentials. They don't even, they don't need a leader, even if they are five. Mm. But the moment they are seven, something begins to happen that they begin to need a leader in order to function and have structured meetings and so on. When you go to 15, it's impossible not to have some kind of rules of engagement with each other. And when you go up to 150, you need management systems in order to, so you, whether that is in excess or not, I don't know. I am there only to ask the questions. Is this useful and why? But the moment you go over 150 people, then something magic happens. And this is that the management systems begin to require service. And sometimes it's service that is required more the service serving the management systems, giving to the management system the information, becomes a goal in itself. That takes more resources than doing the task the organization is for. No? The moment you go over 150, and when you go to 200,000 people in a company or in a public sector, then you begin to see that maybe over 60% of the organization is working on serving the management system that in theory was originally thought to support people doing their task. And now it has become a task in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No? Well, then it's relevant to ask what is in excess here. Okay? Maybe we need to organize ourselves in a different way. Like, for example, downsize the autonomous teams or the autonomous business units. Maybe we shouldn't have business units that are bigger than 15 or 100 people or whatever. Because then we find the right balance between task orientation and management systems orientation.
Mm-hmm.
No? So, and the thing is that those questions are relevant because the more you have management and management systems that are not necessary, the more that is a sign that people are suffering. Also the managers, not only the people that are being managed. And when you depersonalize the management, building management systems that require information in a specific cadence and specific format and so on, then there's lots of people that are completely disconnected from their own humanity and their own and even what's the purpose of the organization, because the purpose of the purpose of the organization becomes to manage itself. See, I can go sometimes to some days, people tell me, what have you been doing this week? Well, this week was a self-administration. I was administering myself. It's sending tax returns, sending invoicing, blah, 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 blah. I haven't done anything productive. I haven't done anything really meaningful. It's just being, it's administrative week, no? So the size of my business is so small that it's only 1 week every 3 months, no? So, but for in some organizations, it's 50, 60% of their resources go to that.
And this might be a side note, but then I hear some people in the, let's say, the AI community, like this thing that's bubbling up, that have, that are expressing this vision that when we have the AI starting to think for themselves, then we are going to be able to make that more efficient. So in a way, we're saying, okay, let's just, what I'm hearing, I'm not interpreting it very sort of, but it still, it's like, I hear more or less this idea that if we just imply another structure on top of the structure that is there now, another technology, another thing, you know, that is not human, then we will reduce that amount, or you know, it will solve it for us or something like that. I mean, basically trying to push the beyond these 150 people. Do you believe
in that? I have no clue about the future. I only know that in the future there is something that will not change, and it is that everything opens new arenas for the fight between, or the tension between, our yearning for being human, or love and paradise and so on, and all our fear and everything that our fear, our pain leads to. So artificial intelligence will be, as internet became, another arena where the deepest drama of humanity happens. So I have no clue about, the only thing I know about the future, and that I believe that I can extrapolate towards the future, is this. This tension between our longing to be human and loving and caring and being cared for and being loved on the one hand, and our fear for being hurt, for having been hurt, and everything that derives from that, like greed, power games, etc., etc. That's the tension that permeates everything.
And I'm also curious about this number, the 150, because it's the Dunbar number also, right? It's popped up as well as some sort of organizational unit that we've had for a really long time in villages and so forth.
Well, I don't know about the scientific studies, the quality of the scientific study that Mr. Dunbar did. There are some people that have been very critics towards it and so on. But what I can say is that my experience corroborates this. My experience is not of 150, but is more or less 120, something like that. Mm-hmm. 15, well, it can be between 12 and 20, I don't know. But I, for example, when I am going to work designing meetings, my experience tells me that shall I invite people to work in groups of five? If the whole group is 15 people, more or less, I need other tools to design the meeting and facilitate it. If it's 150 people or more, because I sometimes design and facilitate meetings of 300 and plus people. No? So meetings, work meetings, not hallelujah events and so on. No? So work meetings, no?
Yeah.
Task-oriented work meetings and so on. I know that I need another type of tools. No? The way of conveying instructions and information needs to be different. No? So for me, the Dunbar sequence 515, 115 makes sense. Even if the exact numbers, I wouldn't say that they are so hard, 515, 115. No? But you ask anybody, if you are in a meeting of five people and you put two more, what happens? And you go back to five, what happens? No? It's not only about who are the people, also. It's also about that. It's not only about who are the people, it's also about how many. No?
Yeah, it's very, I mean, I think it's very tangible, even going from two to three, you know, to like each time something happens and I need to manage more relationships. And then also if people come and go also in meetings, or like if I see that somebody's disconnected, even they're physically there in the room, but they're off somewhere else doing something else. I mean, all of these things have a lot of influence on what is possible, I think.
Yes.
But now, I would like to then sort of roll back to culture. I mean, you showed me this picture that's really been in my mind with this leverage point where you have tasks and things that you need to do, and then you have culture and you have structures. And you can use the structures to change the culture, or you can use the cultures to change the structures. And there's are different approaches there. So I don't know if, but yeah.
Well, first I would like my way of share my understanding of culture, no?
Yeah.
What I would say is culture is to the collective what personality is for the individual, no? Personality, you could say that is a stereotyped way that we have developed to relate with ourselves and the world. That's my personality. A stereotyped way that I have developed, no?
Yeah.
And culture is also a stereotyped way, scripted ways of knowing that we have come somewhere that is familiar and marking a difference towards those that are not part of it, no? So culture is neither good nor bad. It's again, depends how you look at it, but and what values you have. But if we, as I say, culture in itself is never good or bad. But for example, if we put it in the context of organization, is it the culture we need and we want to have in order for this task, for doing this task? Hmm?
But are you saying that culture is a tool alongside the structure?
No, because a tool is something that you can control, and culture you cannot control. No?
Yeah.
The only way of changing a culture is through a shock. I am sure that the culture in Ukraine is changing very much, and it will not be the same after the war, no? So either through a shock or through slow adaptation to other cultures, external, or through small actions repeated inside of that culture by people that want or don't want or consciously want to promote a change within the culture, or maybe just because new generation, new inputs from the outside, and they begin to do things differently, and they do it enough, repeat it enough times, and during long time, so that the culture becomes something different, or at least is nudged in a certain direction. No, so is these three things. And structures. Depends also, it's also these are words that you need to be contextual, no? In an organization, the structures is what makes possible for people to, how can I define this? It's the rules and the systems that people have formalized.
Yeah.
Some people say that they are also informal structures. And then you go back to where's the boundary between structures and cultures. If the structure is informal, is it culture? Is it? It's not really relevant. No? Mm. Where's the boundary between both? No? But the thing is that if you really want to change the structures of organization, you need to work also in the culture. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. In order to change the structures, you need to work on the culture, and in order to change the culture, you need to change the structures. No? And who comes first? Do what you can, wherever you can. No? Yeah? Wherever you can. Because the culture of the organization will not change if it is not exposed to something different in the outside, exposed to a shock, or exposed to the small rain, from the inside, no?
Yeah.
More than the rain as it is from the inside, is more like condensation. Mm. Condensation in the walls and so on of multitude of people doing things slightly different and so on, no? That's why culture change plans never work, no? Because they believe that in 1 year or 2 years they will, no. In 1 year it happens only if you expose it to a shock. Mm-hmm. And if the shock can come from the inside or from the outside, no? I suppose that now Elon Musk has shocked Twitter. And you could say that it's a shock that comes from the inside because he is inside the organization, even if he came from the outside. No? So you can the shock can come from the inside or from the outside, but no.
Yeah. And then the third point that you mentioned there, that small actions repeated. And if I understood our initial, that's typically how you tend to approach these.
Yes. Topics. Yes, that's my favorite way of working. No? So how, in order to move an organization in a certain direction, both culture, structure, and way of working and everything, no, is task-oriented, not people-oriented. No? Task-oriented. What tasks do we want to try to do differently during a period of 6 months or 1 year? And in 1 year, we will see. No? But during 1 year, we will do several parallel prototypes of working in a different way with specific tasks. And so that you are doing experiments in a way, because you don't know exactly how the organization of the future will look. Because the risk is that if you design the organization from the beginning, this is the organization we want to have, no? You will have more of the same. You have shuffled around and lots of people and so on. But when they land, you know, these boxes from Christmas that you have a Santa inside or something like that, and they have snow, and then you move them like this, and then the snow just flies around, and then in the end it falls down the same way, more or less. No?
Yeah.
It says different, but it's the same. No, so that's the risk if you believe that you will be able to change one organization just by doing a plan beforehand. It will be more of the same. But if you go slowly, well, not necessarily slowly, but methodically, doing experiments, trying new ways of doing things within the constraints that you have defined for the future, no? Then you will move the organization in that direction, because it becomes this, the small actions that create a new reality and that give people, if one of the constraints of the future you want is one organization where people can be more in contact with their mission, with their passion, with their love for the planet, for the each other, for themselves, for their family, no? Well, then you know that there are some things that you can't do. No? On the other hand, if you decide that this organization needs a shock because, for whatever reason, because it's such a crisis looming. You know? So then you need to take responsibility that you are acting like God, that you believe that you know that. And maybe you have the responsibility to do that because you are the new CEO. So take responsibility that you are playing God and do exactly the necessary. And acknowledging that by doing what you believe is necessary, and maybe you're the owners, your patrons and so on, if you believe is necessary, you will hurt a lot of people. And take responsibility for that. And keep yourself human doing that. Don't do as many that managers that give the bad news Friday evening when people are going home for a long weekend, and then the morning, Monday morning, when everybody comes, now we orient ourselves towards the future. And then all the sorrow, the anger, the worries, and so on, the people have taken them at home. No, give the bad news on Monday morning and make yourself available for all the people that will be angry at you, that will come to you sobbing because I had my third child today and only for 3 weeks ago I got a new mortgage to go move to a bigger home and you are putting me in the street. No? So I don't mean that you should be, that you shouldn't take the the decisions that for whatever reason you believe are right, or you have been told that are right and you accept. But keep yourself human while doing it. So if you need to give a shock, so keep yourself human. It's the terrible spectacle we have seen in most countries of the world, during the pandemics. Everybody home. And then you could see the military and the police, and it was a police thing, a thing of oppression, a thing of controlling instead of like Jacinta Arden did. This is painful. This is the only way. You keep yourself human giving the bad news, but this puts you in a position of such a vulnerability that it's better to dissociate yourself as a manager or as a politician from your own humanity, because you cannot look at people in the eyes when you are giving them bad news. And sometimes that is necessary to create a culture, a new culture. But if you say that we need this in order for the organization to become more efficient, more humane, more so on, and you yourself are disconnecting yourself from your humanity when you say it, you will not create that culture, because you are not being the change you want to see. You are saying one thing and doing the contrary. So that's, well, you got me going.
It's very interesting to hear it from your experience, because there are stories going around that things, certain things are, you know, some people tell a story that certain things could be easy if you just did it that way or whatever, you know. And my feeling is that when you are truly trying to do something from the heart, with love, something that you are passionate about, something where work is more sort of in the vein of worship than something that you just sort of engage with to survive, then all of this stuff matters, you know, and it is painful. A lot of it is very painful.
I just want to say that love is not enough. So you need love, but you know how to also. You need to have some tools in order to design meetings, to design processes, to facilitate, to be there with people.
Yeah. I'm seeing a number of paths, and then I'm thinking they might take us. I'm also looking at the time, trying to be a responsible podcast host, which is not always so fun. But if we imagine that we are starting to round off this conversation, what did I miss?
Well, at the beginning we were speaking. You promised that we would speak about self-organization.
Oh, that's true. Let's talk about self-organization for a little bit.
Yeah. Well, nowadays, when you were saying that that there are lots of people nowadays saying that there are some things that are easy, no? So, well, one of the things that you can see everywhere, for example, in LinkedIn, is 5 steps towards self-organization, 11 steps towards self-organization, the promises, no? So, and I think that all that is bullshit. I'm sorry, but all that is bullshit and is pernicious, is even dangerous, no? Because those people haven't understood that self-organization happens no matter what. We individuals self-regulate no matter the circumstances. We self-regulate in paradise and we self-regulate in a concentration camp and everything that is in between. In between are many of our organizations, for example, no? And people self-organize also in a concentration camp. So self-organization, you cannot control self-organization. It's impossible, no? People will self-organize no matter what. People will, one of the most important drives, not the only, but one of the most important drives to self-organize is our yearning for love and to love, our yearning for for paradise, for not being afraid, for being at peace, living in a world of abundance, okay? And that's what we try to find in no matter what the circumstances. And that is the essence of self-organization. This connects with what we were speaking about before about Michelangelo. Take away everything that is in excess, mm-hmm. and then people will self-organize in a healthier way. Because they will not need to adapt to lots of things that oppress them. Okay? So self-management is something different. So when many people say that, many consultants speak and write about self-organization, I believe that in reality they are speaking about self-management, self-managed teams, self-managed organizations. But the thing is that for self-management, there is some limits of size. And we are connecting again with Dunbar. Okay. The consequences for self-management in a team of 5, self-management or self-organization are very close to each other. In a team of 15, they are not so close. And when you go up to a group of 150 people, they are detached from each other because management systems and management philosophies and management methods and the tools the managers have read more often than not have no contact at all with the capacity of people to self-organize. But people do it anyhow. Like, for example, everybody in a very hierarchical and bureaucratic organization, everybody knows who they need to speak with in order to get things done.
Yeah.
No? That's self-organization. And that's self-organization in the concentration camp. Because in the concentration camp, people knew also who they needed to speak with in order to, more than that, who they needed to support in order to keep themselves human. And this is the essence of my thoughts on self-organization.
Yeah, thank you. That's so important. And I mean, what you were saying initially about seeing the world as it is in some way, like to actually look at what is there and to accept what is there and work from that. I mean, that seems to be, and so self-organization in this language would be one of those principles that it's going to happen. So if I need to protect myself and I need connection, then I will find one other person maybe, and I will go off and do what I need to do with them, even though I'm not supposed to do that. But in a way, I'm doing what I need to do to cope. And then the more, yeah, it's
you said acceptance is not the same as resignation.
No,
it's two different things, no? Because you resign when, or you resignate, I think. Do you resignate when you lose hope? But no matter what the circumstances are, yeah, the hope of at some point love of being or and be loved, is the last thing we lose. And that's what they could see in the concentration camps by Viktor Frankl in A Man's Search for Meaning. He says, the moment that people lost hope, they died. Because they stopped trying. No? So, we need to accept but never resignate. No? Because hope is the last thing we lose before we die. Well, no, the causality is the other way. When we lose hope, then we die. No? And that is independently if we are optimists or pessimists. No? So I am a pessimist. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong. Mm-hmm. But I very seldom lose hope.
Yeah.
Meaning that there's always something I can do to make things different within these constraints. No? And some people say that they are optimists and they are also hopeful.
Yeah.
No? People that I can't stand is the hopeless optimists, that they are always doing a Munchausen and they are always pulling themselves from the bootstraps, or no, when they have no hope on anything, they are just doing like that. They are tragic. No? Hopeful optimists, they are wonderful to be around with. Hopeful pessimists, well, I don't think that we are as wonderful to have around, but we are okay, no?
Yeah.
And hopeless and pessimists that have lost hope, well, they take their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for this. It's like I'm on some plane. I'm very confused, which is always a good sign because then things are changing. And on some plane, I'm just relaxing into the clarity of which you are in how you are speaking this. It's so nice to have, again, speaking of structure, but it's nice to get these ideas so clearly stated. And then I can kind of, I find out very clearly what I'm surprised about and what I'm not surprised about. And you know, what are the things that I believe that are beliefs, you know, and it's very, it'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting coming days, I think, for me. To be with this stuff, this conversation.
Yes, there's a caveat, and there's that remember that this is my way of making meaning of this mess that is called life and work and organizations and complexity and the world and so on. No? It's not any objective truth, except maybe one thing. I am tempted to believe that there's one thing that is an objective truth, and this that the deep inside every one of us is somebody that wants to love and be loved and wants to live in paradise or something like paradise. That I am tempted to say that is an universal truth. And I am open to be corrected.
And if people want to find you and work with you or interact more with your ideas, where can they do that?
Well, my website is molini.eu or they can follow me on LinkedIn.
I'll put both links in the show notes, so they're clickable there. Thank you very much, Eugenio, for taking the time.
Thank you for your interest and for the conversation. It helps me to move along.